forever. Carla had to save her. I will not be smashed by this, Carla thought. I can live through it. I will be myself again afterward. She led them to the electrocardiogram room. She felt cold, as if her heart were freezing and her thoughts becoming sluggish. Next to the bed was a can of the grease used by the doctors to improve the conductivity of the terminals. She pulled off her underpants, then took a large dab of grease and pushed it into her vagina. That might save her from bleeding. She had to keep her act up. She turned back to the two soldiers. To her horror, three more followed them into the room. She tried to smile, but she could not. She lay on her back and parted her legs. The tall one knelt between her knees. He ripped open her uniform blouse to expose her breasts. She could see that he was manipulating himself, making his penis erect. He lay on top and entered her. She told herself this had no connection with what she and Verna had done together. She turned her head to the side, but the soldier grasped her chin and turned her face back, making her look at him as he thrust inside her. She closed her eyes. She felt him kissing her, trying to force his tongue into her mouth. His breath smelled like rotting meat. When she clamped her mouth shut, he punched her face. She cried out and opened her bruised lips to him. She tried to think how much worse this would have been for a 13-year-old virgin. The soldier grunted and ejaculated inside her. She tried not to let her disgust show on her face. He climbed off, and the fair-haired one took his place. Carla tried to close down her mind, to make her body into something detached, a machine, an object that had nothing to do with her. This one did not want to kiss her, but he sucked her breasts and bit her nipples, and when she cried out in pain, he seemed pleased, and did it harder. Time passed, and he ejaculated. Then another one got on top. She realized that when this was over, she would not be able to bathe or shower, for there was no running water in the city. That thought pushed her over the top. Their fluids would be inside her. Their smell would be on her skin, their saliva in her mouth, and she would have no effective way to wash. Somehow that was worse than everything else. Her courage failed her, and she started to cry. The third soldier satisfied himself, then the fourth lay on her. Chapter 20, 1945, Part 2. Adolf Hitler killed himself on Monday, April 30, 1945, in his bunker in Berlin. Exactly a week later in London, at 7:40 in the evening, the Ministry of Information announced that Germany had surrendered. A holiday was declared for the following day, Tuesday, May 8. Daisy sat at the window of her apartment in Piccadilly, watching the celebrations. The street was thronged with people, making it almost impassable to cars and buses. The girls would kiss any man in uniform, and thousands of lucky servicemen were taking full advantage. By early afternoon, many people were drunk. Through the open window, Daisy could hear distant singing, and guessed that the crowd outside Buckingham Palace was doing Land of Hope and Glory. She shared their happiness, but Lloyd was somewhere in France or Germany, and he was the only soldier she wanted to kiss. She prayed he had not been killed in the last few hours of the war. Lloyd's sister, Millie, showed up with her two children. Millie's husband, Abe Avery, was also with the army somewhere. She and the children had come to the West End to join in the celebrations, and they took a break from the crowds at Daisy's place. The Leckwith home in Aldgate had long been a place of refuge for Daisy, and she was glad to have a chance to reciprocate. She made tea for Millie, her staff were out there celebrating, and poured orange juice for the children. Lenny was 5 now and Pammy 3. Since Abe had been conscripted, Millie had been running his leather wholesaling business. His sister, Naomi Avery, was the bookkeeper, but Millie did the selling. "It's going to change now," Millie said. "For the past 5 years, the demand has been for tough hides for boots and shoes. Now we're going to need softer leathers, calf and pigskin for handbags and briefcases. When the luxury market comes back, there'll be decent money to be made at last." Daisy recalled that her father had the same way of thinking as Millie. Lev, too, was always looking ahead, searching out the opportunities. Ava Murray appeared next, with her 4 children in tow. Jamie, aged 8, organized a game of hide-and-seek, and the apartment became like a kindergarten. Ava's husband, Jimmy, now a colonel, was also somewhere in France or Germany, and Ava was suffering the same agonies of anxiety as Daisy and Millie.
"We'll hear from them any day now," Millie said, "and then it will really be all over."
Ava was also desperate for news of her family in Berlin. However, she thought it might be weeks or months before anyone could learn the fates of individual Germans in the post-war chaos.
"I wonder whether my children will ever know my parents," she said sadly.
At 5 o'clock, Daisy made a pitcher of martinis. Millie went into the kitchen and, with characteristic speed and efficiency, produced a plate of sardines on toast to eat with the drinks. F and Bernie arrived just as Daisy was making a second round. Bernie told Daisy that Lenny could read already, and Pammy could sing the national anthem. Ethel said, "Typical grandfather, thinks there has never been bright children before." But Daisy could tell that in her heart she was just as proud of them. Feeling relaxed and happy halfway down her second martini, she looked around at the disparate group gathered in her home. They had paid her the compliment of coming to her door without an invitation, knowing they would be welcomed. They belonged to her, and she to them. They were, she realized, her family. She felt very blessed. 2. Woody Doer sat outside Leo Shapiro's office, looking through a sheaf of photographs. They were the pictures he had taken at Pearl Harbor in the hour before Joanne died. The film had stayed in his camera for months, but eventually he had developed it and printed the pictures. Looking at them had made him so sad that he had put them in a drawer in his bedroom at the Washington apartment and left them there. But this was a time for change. He would never forget Joanne, but he was in love again, at last. He adored Bella, and she felt the same. When they parted, at the Oakland train station outside San Francisco, he had told her that he loved her, and she had said, "I love you too." He was going to ask her to marry him. He would have done so already, but it seemed too soon, less than 3 months, and he did not want to give her hostile parents a pretext for objecting. Also, he needed to make a decision about his future. He did not want to go into politics. This was going to shock his parents, he knew. They had always assumed he would follow in his father's footsteps and end up as the third Senator Doer. He had gone along with this assumption unthinkingly. But in the war, and especially while in hospital, he had asked himself what he really wanted to do if he survived, and the answer was not politics. This was a good time to leave. His father had achieved his life's ambition. The Senate had debated the United Nations. It was at a similar point in history that the old League of Nations had founded, a painful memory for Gus Doer. But Senator Vandenberg had spoken passionately in favor, speaking of the dearest dream of mankind, and the UN Charter had been ratified by 89 votes to 2. The job was done. Woody would not be letting his father down by quitting now. He hoped Gus would see it that way too. Shapiro opened his office door and beckoned. Woody stood up and went in. Shapiro was younger than Woody had expected, somewhere in his 30s. He was Washington bureau chief for the National Press Agency. He sat behind his desk and said, "What can I do for Senator Doer's son?"
"I'd like to show you some photographs, if I may."
"All right."
Woody spread his pictures on Shapiro's desk.
"Is this Pearl Harbor?"
Shapiro said.
"Yes, December 7th, 1941.
"My God."
Woody was looking at them upside down, but still they brought tears to his eyes. There was Joanne, looking so beautiful, and Chuck, grinning happily to be with his family and Eddie. Then the planes coming over, the bombs and torpedoes dropping from their bellies, the black smoke explosions on the ships, and the sailors scrambling over the sides, dropping into the sea, swimming for their lives.
"This is your father," Shapiro said, "and your mother. I recognize them."
"And my fiancé, who died a few minutes later, my brother who was killed at Bougainville, and my brother's best friend."
"These are fantastic photographs. How much do you want for them?"
"I don't want money," Woody said.
Shapiro looked up in surprise. Woody said, I want a job. 3. 15 days after VE Day, Winston Churchill called a general election. The Leckwith family were taken by surprise. Like most people, Ethel and Bernie had thought Churchill would wait until the Japanese surrendered. The Labour leader, Clement Attlee, had suggested an election in October. Churchill wrong-footed them all. Major Lloyd Williams was released from the army to stand as Labour candidate for Hoxton in the East End of London. He was full of eager enthusiasm for the future envisioned by his party. Fascism had been vanquished, and now British people could create a society that combined freedom with welfare. Labour had a well-thought-out plan for avoiding the catastrophe of the last 20 years. Universal, comprehensive unemployment insurance to help families through hard times, economic planning to prevent another depression, and the United Nations organization to keep the peace. "You don't stand a chance," said his stepfather Bernie in the kitchen of the house in Aldgate on Monday, June 4th. Bernie's pessimism was the more convincing for being so uncharacteristic. "The vote Tory because Churchill won the war," he went on gloomily. "It was the same with Lloyd George in 1918. Lloyd was about to reply, but Daisy got in first. "The war wasn't won by the free market and capitalist enterprise," she said indignantly. "It was people working together and sharing the burdens, everybody doing his bit. That's socialism." Lloyd loved her most when she was passionate, but he was more deliberate. "We already have measures that the old Tories would have condemned as Bolshevism, government control of railways, mines and shipping, for example, all brought in by Churchill, and Ernie Bevin has been in charge of economic planning all through the war." Bernie shook his head knowingly, an old man gesture that irritated Lloyd. "People vote with their hearts, not brains," he said. "They want to show their gratitude." "Well, no point sitting here arguing with you," Lloyd said. "I'm going to argue with voters instead." He and Daisy took a bus a few stops north to the Black Lion pub in Shoreditch, where they met up with a canvassing team from the Hoxton constituency Labour Party. In fact, canvassing was not about arguing with voters, Lloyd knew. Its main purpose was to identify supporters, so that on election day, the party machine could make sure they all went to the polling station. Firm Labour supporters were noted. Firm supporters of other parties were crossed off. Only people who had not yet made up their minds were worth more than a few seconds. They were offered the chance to speak to the candidate. Lloyd got some negative reactions. "Major, eh?" one woman said. "My Alf is a corporal. He says the officers nearly lost us the war." There were also accusations of nepotism. "Aren't you the son of the MP for Aldgate? What is this, a hereditary monarchy?" He remembered his mother's advice. "You never win a vote by proving the constituent a fool. Be charming, be modest, and don't lose your temper. If a voter is hostile and rude, thank him for his time and go away. You'll leave him thinking maybe he misjudged you." Working-class voters were strongly Labour. A lot of people told Lloyd that Attlee and Bevin had done a good job during the war. The waverers were mostly middle-class. When people said that Churchill had won the war, Lloyd quoted Attlee's gentle put-down. "It wasn't a one-man government, and it wasn't a one-man war." Churchill had described Attlee as a modest man with much to be modest about. Attlee's wit was less brutal, and for that reason more effective. At least, Lloyd thought so. A couple of constituents mentioned the sitting MP for Hoxton, a Liberal, and said they would vote for him because he had helped them solve some problem. Members of Parliament were often called upon by constituents who felt they were being treated unjustly by the government, an employer, or a neighbour. It was time-consuming work, but it won votes. Overall, Lloyd could not tell which way public opinion was leaning. Only one constituent mentioned Daisy. The man came to the door with his mouth full of food. Lloyd said, "Good evening, Mr. Perkinson. I understand you wanted to ask me something." "Your fiancé was a fascist," the man said, chewing. Lloyd guessed he had been reading the Daily Mail, which had run a spiteful story about Lloyd and Daisy under the headline, "The Socialist and the Viscountess." Lloyd nodded. "She was briefly fooled by fascism, like many others." "How can a socialist marry a fascist?" Lloyd looked around, spotted Daisy and beckoned her. "Mr. Perkinson here is asking me about my fiancé being an ex-fascist. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Perkinson."
Daisy shook the man's hand. I quite understand your concern. My first husband was a fascist in the 30s, and I supported him. Perkinson nodded. He probably believed a wife should take her views from her husband. How foolish we were, Daisy went on. But when the war came, my first husband joined the RAF and fought against the Nazis as bravely as anyone.
Is that a fact?
Last year, he was flying a typhoon over France, strafing a German troop train, when he was shot down and killed. So I'm a war widow. Perkinson swallowed his food. I'm sorry to hear that, of course. But Daisy had not finished. For myself, I lived in London throughout the war. I drove an ambulance all through the Blitz. Very brave of you, I'm sure. Well, I just hope you think that my late husband and I both paid our dues.
I don't know about that, Perkinson said sulkily.
We won't take up any more of your time, said Lloyd. Thank you for explaining your views to me. Good evening. As they walked away, Daisy said, I don't think we won him around.
You never do, Lloyd said,
but he's seen both sides of the story now, which might make him a bit less vociferous about it later this evening when he talks about us in the pub.
Hmm.
Lloyd sensed he had failed to reassure Daisy. Canvassing finished early, for tonight the first of the radio election broadcasts would be aired on the BBC, and all party workers would be listening. Churchill had the privilege of making the first one. On the bus home, Daisy said, I'm worried. I'm an election liability to you.
No candidate is perfect, Lloyd said.
It's how you deal with your weaknesses that matters.
I don't want to be your weakness. Perhaps I should stay out of the way.
On the contrary, I want everyone to know all about you from the start. If you are a liability, I would get out of politics.
No, no. I'd hate to think I made you give up your ambitions.
It won't come to that, he said. But once again he could see that he had not succeeded in assuaging her anxiety. Back in Nutley Street, the Leckwith family sat around the radio in the kitchen. Daisy held Lloyd's hand.
I came here a lot while you were away, she said. We used to listen to swing music and talk about you.
The thought made Lloyd feel very lucky. Churchill came on. The familiar rasp was stirring. For 5 grim years that voice had given people strength and hope and courage. Lloyd felt despairing. Even he was tempted to vote for this man.
My friends, the Prime Minister said, I must tell you that a socialist policy is abhorrent to the British ideas of freedom.
Well, that was routine knockabout stuff. All new ideas were condemned as foreign imports. But what would Churchill offer people? Labour had a plan. But what did the Conservatives propose?
Socialism is inseparably interwoven with totalitarianism, Churchill said.
Lloyd's mother, Ethel, said, Surely he's not going to pretend we're like the Nazis.
I think he is, though, Bernie said. He'll say we've defeated the enemy abroad. Now we must defeat the enemy in our midst. Standard Conservative tactic.
People won't believe that, Ethel said.
Lloyd said, Hush. Churchill said, A socialist state, once thoroughly completed in all its details and its aspects, could not afford to suffer opposition.
This is outrageous, said Ethel.
But I will go farther, said Churchill. I declare to you, from the bottom of my heart, that no socialist system can be established without a political police.
Political police? Ethel said indignantly. Where is he getting this stuff from?
Bernie said, This is good in a way. He can't find anything to criticize in our manifesto. Therefore he's attacking us for things we aren't actually proposing to do.
Bloody liar.
Lloyd shouted, Listen. Churchill said, They would have to fall back on some form of Gestapo. Suddenly they were all on their feet, shouting protests. The Prime Minister was drowned out.
Bastard!
Bernie yelled, shaking his fist at the Marconi radio set.
Bastard! Bastard!
When they had quietened down, Ethel said, Is that going to be their campaign? Just lies about us?
It bloody well is, said Bernie.
Lloyd said, But will people believe it? 4. In southern New Mexico, not far from El Paso, there is a desert called Jornado del Muerto,
The Voyage of the Dead. All day long, the cruel sun beats down on needlethorn mesquite and sword-leafed yucca plants. The inhabitants are scorpions and rattlesnakes and fire ants and tarantula spiders. Here, the men of the Manhattan Project tested the most dreadful weapon the human race had ever devised. Greg Peshkov was with the scientists watching from 10,000 yards away. He had two hopes. First, that the bomb would work, and second, that 10,000 yards was far enough. The countdown started at 5:09 in the morning, mountain war time, on Monday, July 16th. It was dawn, and there were streaks of gold in the sky to the east. The test was codenamed Trinity. When Greg had asked why, the senior scientist, the pointy-eared Jewish New Yorker J. Robert Oppenheimer, had quoted a poem by John Donne, "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Oppie was the cleverest person Greg had ever met. The most brilliant physicist of his generation, he also spoke six languages. He had read Karl Marx's Capital in the original German. The kind of thing he did for fun was learn Sanskrit. Greg liked and admired him. Most physicists were geeks, but Oppie, like Greg himself, was an exception. Tall, handsome, charming, and a real lady killer. In the middle of the desert, Oppie had instructed the Army Corps of Engineers to build a 100-foot tower of steel struts in concrete footings. On top was an oak platform. The bomb had been winched up to the platform on Saturday. The scientists never used the word bomb. They called it the gadget. At its heart was a ball of plutonium, a metal that did not exist in nature, but was created as a byproduct in nuclear piles. The ball weighed 10 pounds and contained all the plutonium in the world. Someone had calculated that it was worth $1 billion. 32 detonators on the surface of the ball would go off simultaneously, creating such powerful inward pressure that the plutonium would become more dense and go critical. No one really knew what would happen next. The scientists were running a betting pool, dollar a ticket, on the force of the explosion measured in equivalent tons of TNT. Edward Teller bet 45,000 tons. Oppie bet 300 tons. The official forecast was 20,000 tons. The night before, Enrico Fermi had offered to take side bets on whether the blast would wipe out the entire state of New Mexico. General Groves had not found it funny. The scientists had had a perfectly serious discussion about whether the explosion would ignite the atmosphere of the entire Earth and destroy the planet, but they had come to the conclusion that it would not. If they were wrong, Greg just hoped it would happen fast. The trial had originally been scheduled for July 4th. However, every time they tested a component, it failed. So the big day had been postponed several times. Back at Los Alamos, on Saturday, a mock-up they called the Chinese copy had refused to ignite. In the betting pool, Norman Ramsey had picked zero, gambling that the bomb would be a dud. Today, detonation had been scheduled for 2 a.m., but at that time there had been a thunderstorm. In the desert? Rain would bring the radioactive fallout down on the heads of the watching scientists, so the blast was postponed. The storm had ended at dawn. Greg was at a bunker called S-10,000, which was the control room. Like most of the scientists, he was standing outside for a better view. Hope and fear struggled for mastery of his heart. If the bomb was a dud, the efforts of hundreds of people, plus about $2 billion, would have gone for nothing. And if the bomb was not a dud, they might all be killed in the next few minutes. Beside him was Wilhelm Funzer, a young German scientist he had first met in Chicago. What would have happened, Willie, if lightning had struck the bomb? Funzer shrugged. No one knows. A green Very rocket shot into the sky, startling Greg. 5-minute warning, Funzer said. Security had been haphazard. Santa Fe, the nearest town to Los Alamos, was crawling with well-dressed FBI agents. Leaning nonchalantly against walls in their tweed jackets and neckties, they were obvious to local residents, who wore blue jeans and cowboy boots. The Bureau was also illegally tapping the phones of hundreds of people involved in the Manhattan Project. This bewildered Greg. How could the nation's premier law enforcement agency systematically commit criminal acts? Nevertheless, Army Security and the FBI had identified some spies and quietly removed them from the project, including Barney McHugh. But had they found them all? Greg did not know. Groves had been forced to take risks. If he had fired everyone the FBI asked him to, there would not have been enough scientists left to build the bomb. Unfortunately, most scientists were radicals, socialists, and liberals. There was hardly a conservative among them, and they believed that the truths discovered by science were for humankind to share, and should never be kept secret in the service of one regime or country. So, while the American government was keeping this huge project top secret, the scientists held discussion groups about sharing nuclear technology with all the nations of the world. Oppie himself was suspect. The only reason he was not in the Communist Party was that he never joined clubs. Right now, Oppie was lying on the ground next to his kid brother, Frank, also an outstanding physicist, also a communist. They both held pieces of welding glass through which to observe the explosion. Greg and Frunze had similar pieces of glass. Some of the scientists were wearing sunglasses. Another rocket went off.
1 minute, said Frunze.
Greg heard Oppie say, Lord, these affairs are hard on the heart. He wondered if those would be Oppie's last words. Greg and Frunze lay on the sandy earth near Oppie and Frank. They all held their visors of welding glass in front of their eyes and gazed toward the test site. Facing death, Greg thought about his mother, his father, and his sister, Daisy, in London. He wondered how much they would miss him. He thought, with mild regret, of Margaret Cowdrey, who had dumped him for a guy who was willing to marry her. But most of all he thought of Jackie Jakes and Georgie, now 9 years old. He passionately wanted to watch Georgie grow up. He realized Georgie was the main reason he was hoping to stay alive. Stealthily, the child had crept into his soul and stolen his love. The strength of this feeling surprised Greg. A gong chimed, a strangely inappropriate sound in the desert.
10 seconds.
Greg suffered an impulse to get up and run away. Silly though it was, how far could he get in 10 seconds, he had to force himself to lie still. The bomb went off at 5:29:45. First, there was an awesome flash, impossibly bright, the fiercest glare Greg had ever seen, stronger than the sun. Then a weird dome of fire seemed to come out of the ground. With terrifying speed it grew monstrously high. It reached the level of the mountains and continued to rise, rapidly dwarfing the peaks. Greg whispered,
Jesus!
The dome morphed into a square. The light was still brighter than noonday, and the distant mountains were so vividly illuminated that Greg could see every fold and crevice and rock. Then the shape changed again. A pillar appeared below, seeming to push miles into the sky, like the fist of God. The cloud of boiling fire above the pillar spread like an umbrella, until the whole thing looked like a mushroom 7 miles tall. The colors in the cloud were hellish orange, green, and purple. Greg was hit by a wave of heat, as if the Almighty had opened a giant oven. At the same moment, the bang of the explosion reached his ears like the crack of doom. But that was only the beginning. A noise like supernaturally loud thunder rolled over the desert, drowning all other sound. The blazing cloud began to diminish, but the thunder went on and on, impossibly sustained, until Greg wondered if this was the sound of the end of the world. At last it faded away, and the mushroom cloud began to disperse. Greg heard Frank Oppenheimer say,
It worked.
Oppie said, Yes, it worked. The two brothers shook hands. And the world is still here, Greg thought, but it had been forever changed. 5. Lloyd Williams and Daisy went to Hoxton Town Hall on the morning of July 26th to watch the votes being counted. If Lloyd lost, Daisy was going to break off the engagement. He fervently denied that she was a political liability, but she knew better. Lloyd's political enemies made a point of calling her Lady Aberowan. Voters reacted to her American accent by looking indignant, as if she had no right to take part in British politics. Even Labour Party members treated her differently, asking if she would prefer coffee when they were all drinking tea. As Lloyd had forecast, she was often able to overcome people's initial hostility by being natural and charming, and helping the other women wash up the teacups. But was that enough? The election results would give the only definite answer. She was not going to marry him if it meant his giving up his life's work. He said he was willing to do it, but it was a hopeless foundation for marriage. Daisy shuddered with horror as she imagined him doing some other job, working at a bank or in the civil service, miserably unhappy, and trying to pretend it was not her fault. It did not bear thinking about. Unfortunately, everyone thought the Conservatives were going to win the election. Some things had gone Labour's way in the campaign. Churchill's Gestapo speech had backfired. Even Conservatives had been dismayed. Clement Attlee, broadcasting the following evening for Labour, had been coolly ironic. "When I listened to the Prime Minister's speech last night, in which he gave such a travesty of the policy of the Labour Party, I realized at once what was his object. He wanted the voters to understand how great was the difference between Winston Churchill, the great leader in war of a united nation, and Mr. Churchill, the party leader of the Conservatives. He feared lest those who had accepted his leadership in war might be tempted, out of gratitude, to follow him further. I thank him for having disillusioned them so thoroughly." Attlee's magisterial disdain had made Churchill seem a rabble-rouser. People had had too much of blood-red passion, Daisy thought. They would surely prefer temperate common sense in peacetime. A Gallup poll, taken the day before voting, showed Labour winning, but no one believed it. The idea that you could forecast the result by asking a small number of electors seemed a bit unlikely. The News Chronicle, which had published the poll, was predicting a tie. All the other papers said the Conservatives would win. Daisy had never before taken any interest in the mechanics of democracy, but her fate was in the balance now, and she watched, mesmerized, as the voting papers were taken out of the boxes, sorted, counted, bundled, and counted again. The man in charge was called the returning officer, as if he had been away for a while. He was, in fact, the town clerk. Observers from each of the parties monitored the proceedings to make sure there was no carelessness or dishonesty. The process was long, and Daisy felt tortured by suspense. At 10:30, they heard the first result from elsewhere. Harold Macmillan, a protege of Churchill's and a wartime cabinet minister, had lost Stockton-on-Tees to Labour. 15 minutes later, there was news of a huge swing to Labour in Birmingham. No radios were allowed into the hall, so Daisy and Lloyd were relying on rumours filtering in from outside, and Daisy was not sure what to believe. It was midday when the returning officer called the candidates and their agents into a corner of the room to give them the results, before making the announcement publicly. Daisy wanted to go with Lloyd, but she was not permitted. The man spoke quietly to all of them. As well as Lloyd and the sitting MP, there was a Conservative and a Communist. Daisy studied their faces, but could not guess who had won. They all went up onto the platform, and the room fell silent. Daisy felt nauseous. "I, Michael Charles Davis, being the duly appointed returning officer for the parliamentary constituency of Hoxton," Daisy stood with the Labour Party observers and stared at Lloyd. Was she about to lose him? The thought squeezed her heart and made her breathless with fear. In her life she had twice chosen a man who was disastrously wrong. Charlie Farquharson had been the opposite of her father, nice but weak. Boy Fitzherbert had been much like her father, willful and selfish. Now, at last, she had found Lloyd, who was both strong and kind. She had not picked him for his social status, or for what he could do for her, but simply because he was an extraordinarily good man. He was gentle, he was smart, he was trustworthy, and he adored her. It had taken her a long time to realize that he was what she was looking for. How foolish she had been. The returning officer read out the number of votes cast for each candidate. They were listed alphabetically. Sir Williams came last. Daisy was so anxious that she could not keep the numbers in her head.
Reginald Sidney Blenkinsop, 5,427.
When Lloyd's vote was read out, the Labour Party people all around Daisy burst out cheering. It took her a moment to realize that meant he had won. Then she saw his solemn expression turn into a broad grin. Daisy began to clap and cheer louder than anyone. He had won, and she did not have to leave him. She felt as if her life had been saved.
I therefore declare that Lloyd Williams is duly elected Member of Parliament for Hoxton.
Lloyd was a Member of Parliament. Daisy watched proudly as he stepped forward and made an acceptance speech. There was a formula for such speeches, she realized, and he tediously thanked the returning officer and his staff, then thanked his losing opponents for a fair fight. She was impatient to hug him. He finished with a few sentences about the task that lay ahead, of rebuilding war-torn Britain and creating a fairer society. He stood down to more applause. Coming off the stage, he walked straight to Daisy, put his arms around her, and kissed her. She said, "Well done, my darling." Then she found she could no longer speak. After a while, they went outside and caught a bus to Labour Party headquarters at Transport House. There they learned that Labour had already won 106 seats. It was a landslide. Every pundit had been wrong, and everyone's expectations were confounded. When all the results were in, Labour had 393 seats, the Conservatives 210, the Liberals had 12, and the Communists 1. Stepney. Labour had an overwhelming majority. At 7 o'clock in the evening, Winston Churchill, Britain's great war leader, went to Buckingham Palace and resigned as Prime Minister. Daisy thought of one of Churchill's jibes about Attlee. An empty car drew up and Clem got out. The man he called a nonentity had thrashed him. At 7:30, Clement Attlee went to the palace in his own car, driven by his wife, Violet, and King George VI asked him to become Prime Minister. In the house in Nutley Street, after they had all listened to the news on the radio, Lloyd turned to Daisy and said, "Well, that's that. Can we get married now?" "Yes," said Daisy, "as quick as you like."
6.
Volodya and Zoya's wedding reception was held in one of the smaller banqueting halls in the Kremlin. The war with Germany was over, but the Soviet Union was still battered and impoverished, and a lavish celebration would have been frowned upon. Zoya had a new dress, but Volodya wore his uniform. However, there was plenty to eat, and the vodka flowed freely. Volodya's nephew and niece were there, the twin children of his sister Anya and her unpleasant husband, Ilya Dvorkin. They were not yet 6 years old. Dimka, the dark-haired boy, sat quietly reading a book, while blue-eyed Tanya was running around the room, crashing into tables and annoying the guests, in a reversal of the expected behavior of boys and girls. Zoya looked so desirable in pink that Volodya would have liked to leave right away and take her to bed. That was out of the question, of course. His father's circle of friends included some of the most senior generals and politicians in the country, and many of them had come to toast the happy couple. Grigori was hinting that one extremely distinguished guest might arrive later. Volodya hoped it was not the depraved NKVD boss, Bieria. Volodya's happiness did not quite let him forget the horrors he had seen and the profound misgivings he had developed about Soviet communism. The unspeakable brutality of the secret police, the blunders of Stalin that had cost millions of lives, and the propaganda that had encouraged the Red Army to behave like crazed beasts in Germany had all caused him to doubt the most fundamental things he had been brought up to believe. He wondered uneasily what kind of country Dimka and Tanya would grow up in. But today was not the day to think about that. The Soviet elite were in a good mood. They had won the war and defeated Germany. Their old enemy Japan was being crushed by the USA. The insane honor code of Japan's leaders made it difficult for them to surrender, but it was only a matter of time now. Tragically, while they clung to their pride, more Japanese and American troops would die, and more Japanese women and children would be bombed out of their homes, but the end result would be the same. Sadly, it seemed there was nothing the Americans could do to hasten the process and prevent unnecessary deaths. Volodya's father, drunk and happy, made a speech.
The Red Army has occupied Poland, he said. Never again will that country be used as a springboard for a German invasion of Russia. All the old comrades cheered and thumped the tables. In Western Europe, communist parties are being endorsed by the masses as never before. In the Paris municipal elections last March, the Communist Party won the largest share of the vote. I congratulate our French comrades. They cheered again. As I look around the world today, I see that the Russian Revolution, in which so many brave men fought and died... He trailed off as drunken tears came to his eyes. A hush descended on the room. He recovered himself. I see that the revolution has never been as secure as it is today. They raised their glasses. The revolution! The revolution! Everyone drank. The doors flew open, and Comrade Stalin walked in. Everyone stood up. His hair was grey, and he looked tired. He was about 65, and he had been ill. There were rumours that he had suffered a series of strokes or minor heart attacks, but his mood today was ebullient. I have come to kiss the bride, he said. He walked up to Zoya and put his hands on her shoulders. She was a good 3 inches taller than he, but she managed to stoop discreetly. He kissed her on both cheeks, allowing his grey, moustached mouth to linger just long enough to make Volodya feel resentful. Then he stepped back and said, How about a drink for me? Several people hastened to get him a glass of vodka. Grigory insisted on giving Stalin his chair in the center of the head table. The buzz of conversation resumed, but it was subdued. They were thrilled he was here, but now they had to be careful of every word and every move. This man could have a person killed with a snap of his fingers, and he frequently had. More vodka was brought. The band began to play Russian folk dances, and slowly people relaxed. Volodya, Zoya, Grigory, and Katerina did a four-person dance called a quadrille, which was intended to be comic and always made people laugh. After that, more couples danced, and the men started to do the barinya, in which they had to squat and kick up their legs, which caused many of them to fall over. Volodya kept checking on Stalin out of the corner of his eye, as did everyone else in the room, and he seemed to be enjoying himself, tapping his glass on the table in time with the balalaikas. Zoya and Katerina were dancing a troika with Zoya's boss, Vasily, a senior physicist working on the bomb project, and Volodya was sitting out when the atmosphere changed. An aide in a civilian suit came in, hurried around the edge of the room and went right up to Stalin. Without ceremony, he leaned over the leader's shoulder and spoke to him quietly but urgently. Stalin at first looked puzzled and asked a sharp question, then another. Then his face changed. He went pale and seemed to stare at the dancers without seeing them. Volodya said under his breath, What the hell has happened? The dancers had not yet noticed, but those sitting at the head table looked frightened. After a moment, Stalin stood up. Those around him deferentially did the same. Volodya saw that his father was still dancing. People had been shot for less. But Stalin had no eyes for the wedding guests. With the aide at his side, he left the table. He walked toward the door, crossing the dance floor. Terrified revelers jumped out of his way. One couple fell over. Stalin did not seem to notice. The band ground to a halt. Saying nothing, looking at nobody, Stalin left the room. Some of the generals followed him out, looking scared. Another aide appeared, then two more. They all sought out their bosses and spoke to them. A young man in a tweed jacket went up to Vasily. Zoya seemed to know the man and listened intently to him. She looked shocked. Vasily and the aide left the room. Volodya went to Zoya and said, For God's sake, what's going on? Her voice was shaky. The Americans have dropped the nuclear bomb on Japan. Her beautifully pale face seemed even whiter than normal. At first, the Japanese government couldn't figure out what had happened. It took them hours to realize what it was. Are we sure? It flattened 5 square miles of buildings. They estimate that 75,000 people were killed instantly. How many bombs?
One.
One bomb?
Yes. Good God.
No wonder Stalin turned pale. They both stood silent. The news was spreading around the room visibly,
Some people sat stunned. Others got up and left, heading for their offices, their telephones, their desks, and their staffs.
This changes everything, Volodya said.
Including our honeymoon plans, said Zoya. My leave is sure to be cancelled.
We thought the Soviet Union was safe.
Your father has just made a speech about how the revolution has never been so secure.
Now nothing is secure.
No,
said Zoya.
Not until we have a bomb of our own.
7. Jackie Jakes and Georgie were in Buffalo, staying at Marga's apartment for the first time. Greg and Lev were there too, and on Victory in Japan Day, Wednesday, August 15th, they all went to Humboldt Park. The paths were crowded with jubilant couples, and there were hundreds of children splashing in the pond. Greg was happy and proud. The bomb had worked. The two devices dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki had wreaked sickening devastation, but they had brought the war to a quick end and saved thousands of American lives. Greg had played a role in that. Because of what they had all done, Georgie was going to grow up in a free world.
He's 9, Greg said to Jackie.
They were sitting on a bench, talking, while Lev and Marga took Georgie to buy ice cream.
I can hardly believe it.
What will he be, I wonder?
Jackie said fiercely, he's not going to do something stupid like acting or playing the goddamn trumpet.
He's got brains.
Would you like him to be a college professor like your father?
Yes.
In that case, Greg had been leading up to this, and was nervous about how Jackie might react. He ought to go to a good school.
What did you have in mind?
How about boarding school?
He could go where I went. He'd be the only black pupil.
Not necessarily. When I was there, we had a colored guy, an Indian from Delhi, called Kamal.
Just one?
Yes.
Was he teased?
Sure. We called him Camel. But the boys got used to him, and he made some friends.
What happened to him, do you know?
He became a pharmacist. I hear he already owns 2 drugstores in New York. Jackie nodded. Greg could tell that she was not opposed to this plan. She came from a cultured family. Although she herself had rebelled and dropped out, she believed in the value of education.
What about the school fees?
I could ask my father.
Would he pay?
Look at them. Greg pointed along the path. Lev, Marga, and Georgie were returning from the ice cream vendor's cart. Lev and Georgie were walking side by side, eating ice cream cones, holding hands. My conservative father, holding the hand of a colored child in a public park. Trust me, he'll pay the school fees.
Georgie doesn't really fit anywhere,
Jackie said, looking troubled. He's a black boy with a white daddy.
I know.
People in your mother's apartment building think I'm the maid. Did you know that?
Yes.
I've been careful not to set them straight. If they thought Negroes were in the building as guests, there might be trouble.
Greg sighed.
I'm sorry, but you're right. Life is going to be tough for Georgie.
I know, said Greg, but he's got us. Jackie gave him a rare smile.
Yeah,
she said.
That's something.
Part 3. The Cold Peace. Chapter 21. 1945. Part 3. After the wedding, Volodya and Zoya moved into an apartment of their own. Few Russian newlyweds were so lucky. For 4 years, the industrial might of the Soviet Union had been directed to making weapons. Hardly any homes had been built, and many had been destroyed. But Volodya was a major in Red Army intelligence, as well as the son of a general, and he was able to pull strings. It was a compact space, a living room with a dining table, a bedroom so small the bed almost filled it, a kitchen that was crowded with 2 people in it, a cramped toilet with a wash basin and shower, and a tiny hall with a closet for their clothes. When the radio was on in the living room, they could hear it all over the flat. They quickly made it their own. Zoya bought a bright yellow coverlet for the bed. Volodya's mother produced a set of crockery that she had bought in 1940, in anticipation of his wedding, and saved all through the war. Volodya hung a picture on the wall, a graduation photograph of his class at the Military Intelligence Academy. They made love more now. Being alone made a difference Volodya had not anticipated.
He had never felt particularly inhibited when sleeping with Zoya at his parents' place, or in the apartment she had used to share, but now he realized it had an influence. You had to keep your voice down. You listened in case the bed squeaked, and there was always the possibility, albeit remote, that somebody would walk in on you. Other people's homes were never completely private. They often woke early, made love, then lay kissing and talking for an hour before getting dressed for work. Lying with his head on her thighs, on one such morning, the smell of sex in his nostrils, Volodya said, "Do you want some tea?"
"Yes, please."
She stretched luxuriously, reclining on the pillows. Volodya put on a robe and crossed the tiny hallway to the little kitchen, where he lit the gas under the samovar. He was displeased to see the pots and dishes from last night's dinner stacked in the sink.
"Zoya," he said, "this kitchen's in a mess."
She could hear him easily in the small apartment.
"I know," she said.
He went back to the bedroom.
"Why didn't you clean up last night?"
"Why didn't you?" It had not occurred to him that it might be his responsibility. But he said,
"I had a report to write, and I was tired."
The suggestion that it was his fault irritated him.
"I hate a filthy kitchen."
"So do I." Why was she being so obtuse?
"If you don't like it, clean it.
Let's do it together, right away."
She sprang out of bed. She pushed past him with a sexy smile and went into the kitchen. Volodya followed. She said,
"You wash?
I'll dry."
She took a clean towel from a drawer. She was still naked. He could not help but smile. Her body was long and slim, and her skin was white. She had flat breasts and pointed nipples, and the hair of her groin was fine and blonde. One of the joys of being married to her was her habit of moving around the apartment in the nude. He could stare at her body for as long as he liked. She seemed to enjoy it. If she caught his eye, she showed no embarrassment, but just smiled. He rolled up the sleeves of his robe and began to wash the dishes, passing them to Zoya to dry. Washing up was not a very manly activity. Volodya had never seen his father do it. But Zoya seemed to think such chores should be shared. It was an eccentric idea. Did Zoya have a highly developed sense of fairness in marriage? Or was he being emasculated? He thought he heard something outside. He glanced into the hall. The apartment door was only 3 or 4 steps from the kitchen sink. He could see nothing out of the ordinary. Then the door was smashed open. Zoya screamed. Volodya picked up the carving knife he had just washed. He stepped past Zoya and stood in the kitchen doorway. A uniformed policeman, holding a sledgehammer, was just outside the ruined door. Volodya was filled with fear and rage. He said, "What the fuck is this?" The policeman stepped back, and a small, thin man with a face like a rodent entered the flat. It was Volodya's brother-in-law, Ilya Dvorkin, an agent of the secret police. He was wearing leather gloves.
"Ilya," said Volodya, "you stupid weasel."
"Speak respectfully," said Ilya.
Volodya was baffled as well as angry. The secret police did not normally arrest the staff of Red Army Intelligence, and vice versa. Otherwise it would have been gang warfare.
"Why the hell have you busted my door? I would have opened it."
2 more agents stepped into the hall and stood behind Ilya. They wore their trademark leather coats, despite the mild late summer weather. Volodya was fearful. What was going on? Ilya said in a shaky voice,
"Put the knife down, Volodya."
"No need to be afraid," said Volodya. "I was just washing up."
He handed the knife to Zoya, standing behind him.
"Please step into the living room. We can talk while Zoya gets dressed."
"Do you imagine this is a social call?"
Ilya said indignantly.
"Whatever kind of call it is, I'm sure you don't want the embarrassment of seeing my wife naked."
"I am here on official police business."
"Then why did they send my brother-in-law?"
Ilya lowered his voice.
"Don't you understand that it would be much worse for you if someone else had come?"
This looked like bad trouble. Volodya struggled to keep up the facade of bravado.
"Exactly what do you and these other assholes want?"
"Comrade Bierya has taken over the direction of the nuclear physics program."
Volodya knew that. Stalin had set up a new committee to direct the work and made Bierya chairman. Bierya knew nothing about physics,
and was completely unqualified to organize a scientific research project. But Stalin trusted him. It was the usual problem of Soviet government. Incompetent but loyal people were promoted into jobs they could not cope with. Volodya said, "And Comrade Bierya needs my wife in her laboratory, developing the bomb. Have you come to drive her to work?"
"The Americans created their nuclear bomb before the Soviets."
"Indeed.
Could they perhaps have given research physics higher priority than we did? It is not possible that capitalist science should be superior to communist science."
"This is a truism." Volodya was puzzled. Where was this heading?
"So what do you conclude?"
"There must have been sabotage."
That was exactly the kind of ludicrous fantasy the secret police would dream up.
What kind of sabotage?
"Some of the scientists deliberately delayed the development of the Soviet bomb."
Volodya began to understand, and he felt afraid. But he continued to respond belligerently. It was always a mistake to show weakness with these people.
"Why the hell would they do that?"
"Because they are traitors. And your wife is one."
"You'd better not be serious, you piece of shit."
"I am here to arrest your wife."
"What?"
Volodya was flabbergasted.
"This is insane."
"It is the view of my organization.
There is no evidence."
"For evidence, go to Hiroshima."
Zoya spoke for the first time since she had screamed.
"I'll have to go with them, Volodya. Don't get yourself arrested, too."
Volodya pointed a finger at Ilya.
"You are in so much fucking trouble."
"I'm carrying out my orders."
"Step out of the way.
My wife is going into the bedroom to get dressed."
"No time for that," said Ilya. "She must come as she is."
"Don't be ridiculous."
Ilya put his nose in the air.
"A respectable Soviet citizen would not walk around the apartment with no clothes on."
Volodya wondered briefly how his sister felt, being married to this creep.
"You, the secret police, morally disapprove of nudity?"
"Her nakedness is evidence of her degradation. We will take her as she is."
"No, you fucking won't."
"Stand aside."
"You stand aside. She's going to get dressed."
Volodya stepped into the hall and stood in front of the three agents, holding his arms out so that Zoya could pass behind him. As she moved, Ilya reached past Volodya and grabbed her arm. Volodya punched him in the face, twice. Ilya cried out and staggered back. The two men in leather coats stepped forward. Volodya aimed a punch at one, but the man dodged it. Then each man took one of Volodya's arms. He struggled, but they were strong and seemed to have done this before. They slammed him against the wall. While they held him, Ilya punched him in the face with leather-gloved fists, twice, three times, four, then in the stomach, again and again, until Volodya puked blood. Zoya tried to intervene, but Ilya punched her too, and she screamed and fell back. Volodya's bathrobe came open in front. Ilya kicked him in the balls, then kicked his knees. Volodya sagged, unable to stand, but the two men in leather coats held him up, and Ilya punched him some more. At last Ilya turned away, rubbing his knuckles. The other two released Volodya and he crumpled to the floor. He could hardly breathe and felt unable to move, but he was conscious. Out of the corner of his eye he saw the two heavies grab Zoya and march her naked out of the apartment. Ilya followed. As the minutes went by, the pain changed from sharp agony to deep, dull ache, and Volodya's breathing began to return to normal. Motion eventually returned to his limbs, and he dragged himself upright. He made it to the phone and dialed his father's number, hoping the old man had not yet left for work. He was relieved to hear his father's voice.
"They've arrested Zoya," he said. "Fucking bastards,"
Grigori said.
"Who was it?"
"It was Ilya."
"What?"
"Make some calls," Volodya said. "See if you can find out what the fuck is going on. I have to wash off the blood."
"What blood?"
Volodya hung up. It was only a couple of steps to the bathroom. He dropped his blood-stained robe and got into the shower. The warm water brought some relief to his bruised body. Ilya was mean but not strong, and he had not broken any bones. Volodya turned off the water. He looked in the bathroom mirror. His face was covered with cuts and bruises. He did not bother to dry himself. With considerable effort, he got dressed in his Red Army uniform. He wanted the symbol of authority.
His father arrived as he was trying to tie the laces of his boots.
"What the fucking hell happened here?"
Grigori roared. Volodya said, "They were looking for a fight, and I was foolish enough to give them one." His father was unsympathetic at first.
"I'd have expected you to know better. They insisted on taking her away naked. Fucking crips. Did you find out anything?"
"Not yet. I talked to a couple of people. No one knows anything."
Grigori looked worried.
"Either someone has made a really stupid mistake, or for some reason they're very sure of themselves. Drive me to my office. Lemitov is going to be mad as hell. He won't let them get away with this. If they are allowed to do it to me, they'll do it to all of Red Army intelligence."
Grigori's car and driver were waiting outside. They drove to the Khudina airfield. Grigori stayed in the car while Volodya limped into Red Army intelligence headquarters. He went straight to the office of his boss, Colonel Lemitov. He tapped on the door, walked in and said,
"The fucking secret police have arrested my wife."
"I know," said Lemitov.
"You know?
I okayed it."
Volodya's jaw dropped.
"What the fuck?
Sit down. What is going on?
Sit down and shut up and I'll tell you."
Volodya eased himself painfully into a chair. Lemitov said,
"We have to have a nuclear bomb, and fast. At the moment, Stalin is playing it tough with the Americans, because we're fairly sure they don't have a big enough arsenal of nuclear weapons to wipe us out. But they're building a stockpile, and at some point they will use them, unless we are in a position to retaliate."
This made no sense.
"My wife can't design the bomb while the secret police are punching her in the face. This is insane."
"Shut the fuck up.
Our problem is that there are several possible designs. The Americans took 5 years to figure out which would work. We don't have that much time. We have to steal their research. We'll still need Russian physicists to copy the design, and for that, they have to be in their laboratories, not locked in the basement of the Lubyanka. You know a man called Wilhelm Frunze. I was at school with him, the Berlin Boys Academy. He gave us valuable information about British nuclear research. Then he moved to the States, where he worked on the nuclear bomb project. The Washington staff of the NKVD contacted him, scared him by their incompetence, and fucked up the relationship. We need to win him back."
"What has all this got to do with me?"
"He trusts you."
"I don't know that. I haven't seen him for 12 years.
We want you to go to America and talk to him."
"But why did you arrest Zoya?"
"To make sure you come back."
2. Volodya told himself he knew how to do this. In Berlin, before the war, he had shaken off Gestapo tales, met with potential spies, recruited them, and made them into reliable sources of secret intelligence. It was never easy, especially the part where he had to talk someone into turning traitor. But he was an expert. However, this was America. The Western countries he had visited, Germany and Spain in the 30s and 40s, were nothing like this. He was overwhelmed. All his life he had been told that Hollywood movies gave an exaggerated impression of prosperity, and that in reality, most Americans lived in poverty. But it was clear to Volodya, from the day he arrived in the USA, that the movies hardly exaggerated at all. And poor people were hard to find. New York was jammed with cars, many driven by people who clearly were not important government officials. Youngsters, men in work clothes, even women out shopping. And everybody was so well-dressed. All the men appeared to be wearing their best suits. The women's calves were clad in sheer stockings. Everyone seemed to have new shoes. He had to keep reminding himself of the bad side of America. There was poverty, somewhere. Negroes were persecuted, and in the South they could not vote. There was a lot of crime. Americans themselves said that it was rampant, although, strangely, Volodya did not actually see any evidence of it, and he felt quite safe walking the streets. He spent a few days exploring New York. He worked on his English, which was not good, but it hardly mattered. The city was full of people who spoke broken English with heavy accents. He got to know the faces of some of the FBI agents assigned to tail him, and identified several convenient locations where he would be able to lose them. One sunny morning, he left the Soviet consulate in New York, hatless, and wearing only gray slacks and a blue shirt, as if he were going to run a few errands. A young man in a dark suit and tie followed him. He went to the Saks Fifth Avenue department store and bought underwear and a shirt with a small brown checked pattern. Whoever was tailing him had to think he was probably just shopping. The NKVD chief at the consulate had announced that a Soviet team would shadow Volodya throughout his American visit, to make sure of his good behavior. He could barely contain his rage at the organization that had imprisoned Zoya, and he had to repress the urge to take the man by the throat and strangle him. But he had remained calm. He had pointed out sarcastically that, in order to fulfill his mission, he would have to evade FBI surveillance, and in doing so he might inadvertently also lose his NKVD tail. But he wished them luck. Most days he shook them off in 5 minutes. So the young man tailing him was almost certainly an FBI agent. His crisply conservative clothes corroborated that. Carrying his purchases in a paper bag, Volodya left the store by a side entrance and hailed a cab. He left the FBI man at the curb waving his arm. When the cab had turned two corners, Volodya threw the driver a bill and jumped out. He darted into a subway station, left again by a different entrance, and waited in the doorway of an office building for 5 minutes. The young man in the dark suit was nowhere to be seen. Volodya walked to Penn Station. There he double-checked that he was not being followed, then bought his ticket. With nothing but that and his paper bag, he boarded a train. The journey to Albuquerque took 3 days. The train sped through mile after endless mile of rich farmland, mighty factories belching smoke, and great cities with skyscrapers pointing arrogantly at the heavens. The Soviet Union was bigger, but apart from the Ukraine, it was mostly pine forests and frozen steppes. He had never imagined wealth on this scale. And wealth was not all. For several days, something had been nagging at the back of Volodya's mind, something strange about life in America. Eventually, he realized what it was. No one asked for his papers. After he had passed through immigration control in New York, he had not shown his passport again. In this country, it seemed, anyone could walk into a railway station or a bus terminus and buy a ticket to any place without having to get permission or explain the purpose of the trip to an official. It gave him a dangerously exhilarating sense of freedom. He could go anywhere. America's wealth also heightened Volodya's sense of the danger his country faced. The Germans had almost destroyed the Soviet Union, and this country was 3 times as populous and 10 times as rich. The thought that Russians might become underlings, frightened into subservience, softened Volodya's doubts about communism, despite what the NKVD had done to him and his wife. If he had children, he did not want them to grow up in a world tyrannized by America. He traveled via Pittsburgh and Chicago and attracted no attention en route. His clothes were American, and his accent was not noticed for the simple reason that he spoke to no one. He bought sandwiches and coffee by pointing and paying. He flicked through newspapers and magazines that other travelers left behind, looking at the pictures and trying to work out the meanings of the headlines. The last part of the journey took him through a desert landscape of desolate beauty, with distant snowy peaks stained red by the sunset, which probably explained why they were called the Blood of Christ Mountains. He went to the toilet, where he changed his underwear and put on the new shirt he had bought in Saks. He expected the FBI or Army security to be watching the train station in Albuquerque, and sure enough, he spotted a young man whose check jacket, too warm for the climate of New Mexico in September, did not quite conceal the bulge of a gun in a shoulder holster. However, the agent was undoubtedly interested in long-distance travelers who might be arriving from New York or Washington. Volodya, with no hat or jacket and no luggage, looked like a local man coming back from a short trip. He was not followed as he walked to the bus station and boarded a Greyhound for Santa Fe. He reached his destination late in the afternoon. He noted 2 FBI men at the Santa Fe bus station, and they scrutinized him. However, they could not tell everyone who got off the bus, and once again his casual appearance caused them to dismiss him. Doing his best to look as if he knew where he was going, he strolled along the streets. The low, flat-roofed, Pueblo-style houses and squat churches baking in the sun reminded him of Spain. The storefront buildings overhung the sidewalks, creating pleasantly shady arcades. He avoided La Fonda, the big hotel on the town square next to the cathedral, and checked into the St. Francis. He paid cash and gave his name as Robert Pender, which might have been American or one of several European nationalities.
"My suitcase will be delivered later," he said to the pretty girl behind the reception desk. "If I'm out when it comes, can you make sure it gets sent up to my room?"
"Oh, sure. That won't be a problem," she said.
"Thank you," he said.
Then he added a phrase that he had heard several times on the train.
"I sure appreciate it."
"If I'm not here, someone else will deal with the bag, so long as it has your name on it."
"It does."
He had no luggage, but she would never realize that. She looked at his entry in the book. "So, Mr. Pender, you're from New York?" There was a touch of skepticism in her voice, no doubt because he did not sound like a New Yorker.
"I'm from Switzerland, originally," he explained, naming a neutral country.
"That accounts for the accent. I haven't met a Switzerland person before. What's it like there?" Volodya had never been to Switzerland, but he had seen photographs.
"It snows a lot," he said.
"Well, enjoy our New Mexico weather."
"I will."
5 minutes later, he went out again. Some of the scientists lived at the Los Alamos laboratory, he had learned from his colleagues in the Soviet embassy, but it was a shanty town, with few civilized comforts, and they preferred to rent houses and apartments nearby if they could. Willy Frunze could afford it easily. He was married to a successful artist who drew a syndicated strip cartoon called Slack Alice. His wife, also called Alice, could work anywhere, so they had a place in the historic downtown neighborhood. The New York office of the NKVD had provided this information. They had researched Frunze carefully, and Volodya had his address and phone number and a description of his car, a pre-war Plymouth convertible with white-walled tires. The Frunze's building had an art gallery on the ground floor. The apartment upstairs had a large north-facing window that would appeal to an artist. A Plymouth convertible was parked outside. Volodya preferred not to go in. The place might be bugged. The Frunzes were an affluent, childless couple, and he guessed they would not stay at home listening to the radio on a Friday night. He decided to wait around and see if they came out. He spent some time in the art gallery, looking at the paintings for sale. He liked clear, vivid pictures, and would not have wanted to own any of these messy daubs. He found a coffee shop down the block and got a window seat from which he could just see the Frunze's door. He left there after an hour, bought a newspaper, and stood at a bus stop, pretending to read it. The long wait permitted him to establish that no one was watching the Frunze apartment. That meant the FBI and army security had not tagged Frunze as a high risk. He was a foreigner, but so were many of the scientists, and presumably nothing else was known against him. This was a downtown commercial district, not a residential neighborhood, and there were plenty of people on the streets. But all the same, after a couple of hours, Volodya began to worry that someone might notice him hanging around. Then the Frunzes came out. Frunze was heavier than he had been 12 years ago. There was no shortage of food in America. His hair was beginning to recede, although he was only 30. He still had that solemn look. He wore a sport shirt and khaki pants, a common American combination. His wife was not so conservatively dressed. Her fair hair was pinned up under a beret, and she wore a shapeless cotton dress in an indistinct brown color. But she had an assortment of bangles on both wrists and numerous rings. Artists had dressed like that in Germany before Hitler, Volodya remembered. The couple set off along the street, and Volodya followed. He wondered what the wife's politics were, and what difference her presence would make in this difficult conversation he was about to have. Frunze had been a staunch social democrat back in Germany, so it was not likely his wife would be a conservative, a speculation that was borne out by her appearance. On the other hand, she probably did not know he had given secrets to the Soviets in London. She was an unknown quantity. He would prefer to deal with Frunze alone, and he considered leaving them and trying again tomorrow. but the hotel receptionist had noticed his foreign accent, so by the morning he might have an FBI tape.